That melody starts before you're ready for it. There's a half bar rest right at the top. The beat one is silent, and then the notes just come in like a waterfall pouring sideways. Bebop eighth notes, arpeggiated through the changes of Back Home Again in Indiana, but so far from Indiana, you'd never know it. The tune is called Donna Lee, and it is, depending on who you ask, it's either a Charlie Parker composition or a Miles Davis composition, or maybe even the work of a drummer named Tiny Conn, who died young and never got the credit. Nobody knows for certain. The copyright says Parker. Miles says Davis. And Gil Evans, one of the shrewdest ears in the jazz history, said on the radio that Tiny Conn taught the melody to Miles, who taught it to Bird, who recorded it in 1947 and let the record company sort it out. And that's where we're starting tonight.
I'm Joanna O'Neill, and this is the Standard Show on Big E Radio, coming to you from Edmonton, Alberta. Each episode, I take a single jazz standard from the real book, we dig into where it came from, who played it, what made it stick, and what the chart does or doesn't tell you. Tonight's standard is one that launched 1,000 woodshedding sessions, broken the confidence of 1,000 trumpet players, and somehow managed to be simultaneously one of the most recorded bebop heads in the canon and one of the most genuinely disputed compositions in jazz history. Donna Lee, a 32-bar rocket ship built on Indiana changes, attributed to Charlie Parker, claimed by Miles Davis, possibly invented by someone else entirely, and commented into the real book under the name that might be wrong. Tonight, we're going to trace the tune back to its complicated origins. We'll spend some time with Bird, his Kansas City childhood, his years bumming through the jam session circuit, his extraordinary compositional method of writing new melodies over existing chord structures. We'll look at Miles Davis in 47, 21 years old, barely in New York, already recorded on nearly 24 sessions and claiming in his own autobiography that Donna Lee is his first composition. We'll talk about Tiny Conn, a drummer, arranger, a composer who barely registers in the histories, but who, according to Gil Evans, may be where the melody actually started. We'll go into the May 8th, 1947 Savoy session in detail. Who was in the room, what four takes they recorded, and why the fourth is the one. We'll hear what happened when Gil Evans heard the tune and asked Miles if he could arrange it for big band, and how that conversation directly seeded the idea that became the birth of cool. We'll cover the essential versions, Parker's own original with Miles on trumpet and Bud Powell at the piano, Clifford Brown's jaw-dropping 1956 Philadelphia jam session recording, the last time he ever played the tune, hours before the car accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Jaco Pastorius' 1976 solo fretless bass and conga version, which changed what musicians thought a bass could really do. Anthony Braxton's 1972 Paris deconstruction, which asked whether a bebop head could survive being taken apart by the avant-garde. And Tito Puente, who heard the Indiana changes, and he heard Cuba in them. And we'll spend time with that good old real book. Let's see, there must be something I haven't pulled a thread of yet. The question of who decided what went into the book in the first place. The anonymous Berkeley students who compiled the original book in the early 70s made choices. They chose which songs counted as the canon. Donna Lee made the cut, attributed to Charlie Parker. That attribution has been in every version of the book since, including the Hal Leonard 6th edition. The copyright still says Charlie Parker, which means the real book doesn't just codify a wrong melody or a wrong chart. It codified a wrong name and locked it in. So stick around. This one's got mystery at its center, and the mystery doesn't resolve. Charles Parker Jr. was born August 29, 1920 in Kansas City, Kansas, and grew up across the river in Kansas City, Missouri. His mother, Addie, raised him largely on her own after his father, a stage entertainer who also worked the railroads, left the family when Charlie was young. Kansas City in the 30s was one of the richest musical environments in North America, a wide-open city under the Pendergast political machine, where clubs ran all night, where the big city swing bands circled through constantly, and where a young saxophonist could play for hours and hear something new every time. Parker absorbed all of it. By age 15, he was playing professionally. By 16, he was married. By 17, he was a father. And somewhere along the way, possibly as early as 15 or 16 years
years old, he was introduced to heroin, a fact that would shadow everything that came after.
His early years as a musician are the stuff of jazz legends. At one of his first Kansas City jam sessions, he tried to sit in on I Got Rhythm and was publicly humiliated. The drummer, Joe Jones, reportedly threw a cymbal at his feet to signal him off the stage. Parker went home. He went to the Ozarks and played with a band led by George Lee, and he really practiced. In the Ozarks, he found the musician who would change everything about how he thought about the saxophone. That's Lester Young, Prez, the president of the tenor saxophone, recorded in 1937 with Count Basie's band. And what you're hearing is the foundation of Charlie Parker's entire conception of what improvisation could be. Parker spent that summer in the Ozarks memorizing Lester Young's recorded solos off 78 RPM records, all of them. He played them back on his horn until they were inside him. What he was absorbing wasn't just notes, it was a philosophy. Young played differently from every tenor saxophone who came before him. Where Coleman Hawkins, the other titan of the era, played a heavy, dense, almost orchestral sound, muscular, the notes landing with heavy weight, Young is light and flirty, hairy. His tone had a keening quality, almost like a vocal. And his phrases didn't land where you expected them to. They floated across bar lines. They started a little behind the beat and then surged forward, creating a kind of rhythm elasticity that felt like the music was breathing rather than marching. Young also played with a melodic logic that went beyond just running scales. Each phrase is a statement connected to the last, building on an argument over the course of a solo. It was more like composition than decoration. And then Parker took all of that, the light tone, the long phrases, the rhythmic looseness, the idea of improvisation as construction, and ran it through the harmonic discoveries he was making simultaneously. He pushed the harmony further than Young had, using the upper extension of chords, the 9, 11, 13, as melodic material. He doubled and tripled the tempo Young was working at. But the underlying logic, the phrase as a sentence, solo as argument, rhythm as something you play with rather than something you just submit to, that's Lester Young, retooled for the bebop era. Before we go any further, I want to take a minute for everyone who doesn't read music, because we're going to be talking about chord changes and what playing over Indiana for the rest of the episode means. And if you don't play an instrument, that phrase can be sound like jargon. So let me just explain it, because once you've heard it, you'll never mishear it again. A chord is what happens when you play several notes at the same time, a stack of sound that creates a particular emotional color. Major chords sound bright and open, minor chords sound darker, more closed. There are dozens of variations in between. A chord progression or chord changes is the sequence of those chords moving through a piece of music over time. It's the harmonic landscape the melody lives in, the ground the tune walks over. Back Home Again in Indiana is a 1917 popular song, the kind of thing Louis Armstrong played at outdoor concerts, the kind of tune that appeared in every dance band's book in the swing era. It has a specific sequence of chords. They move in a particular order. They hit certain emotional places at certain moments in the song, and they resolve. They kind of come home at predictable intervals. The chord changes to Indiana are friendly and logical. Musicians who played that era knew them cold. What bebop musicians figured out, and this is the core of what makes bebop bebop, is that the melody and the chord changes don't have to be the same song. You can take the chord changes from one song and write a completely different melody over them. The new melody follows the same harmonic roadmap
It goes somewhere the original never went. And this is called a contrafact, a new melody composed over an existing harmonic structure. Think of it this way. Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and the Alphabet Song are both sung over the same changes, even though the melodies are different and you know them as different songs. The same thing is happening here with Donna Lee. Why Indiana specifically? Particularly because the changes are well known and universally understood, so you didn't need to explain the roadmap to everyone in the room. Partly because the harmonic movement has a particular buoyancy to it. Those chord changes just want to move. They have a forward momentum that suits an up-tempo bebop line. And partly because a familiar harmonic structure gives bebop musicians a way to compose in real time. You know where you are because you know the changes, which frees your attention to focus on the melody itself and on what you're actually saying. Donna Lee isn't the only bebop head on Indiana Changes. Fats Navarro had one called Ice Freezes Red. The whole family of Indiana contrafacts was circulating through the jam sessions of the 40s as common creative property. Lines built from lines, musicians adding their own roots to the same street grid, which means there's more than one reason that the authorship of Donna Lee is hard to pin down. When a melody emerges from that kind of collective improvisation, who wrote it is a really complicated question. Now, let's talk about Miles Davis in 1947. Miles Dewey Davis III was born May 26, 1926 in Alton, Illinois, to a very comfortable middle-class family. His father was a dental surgeon. His mother, Cleota Henry Davis, was an accomplished musician who played violin. Miles grew up in East St. Louis, started on the trumpet at about 13 years old. By 16, he was good enough to be mentored by the great Clark Terry. In 1944, at 18, he came to New York ostensibly to attend the Juilliard School, but really to find Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. He found them, moved in with Parker for a period, and absorbed everything. By 1947, Miles Davis is 21 years old. He's been on roughly 25 recording sessions and was developing a reputation, not as a bebop burner in the mold of Dizzy or Fats Navarro, but as a player with an unusual quality of restraint, a darker and more interior tone, a different relationship to the changes. He was trying to find his own voice inside of bebop, which was not the same thing as being able to play bebop at its most extreme. And this is relevant to the authorship question because many musicians who knew both men have said, privately and publicly, that Donna Lee doesn't sound like a Miles Davis tune. It doesn't have his mature compositional voice. It sounds like someone writing a fast bebop line to prove something, to demonstrate that they could do it at that speed. One theory is that Miles wrote the tune specifically to answer the critics who suggested that he lacked those speed chops. Another has it that the tune is kind of an homage to Fats Navarro's styles of phrasing. Another has it that the tune is a kind of homage to the Fats Navarro style of phrasing, with longer lines and less of the short syncopated phrases that characterize Bird's other heads. In his autobiography, Miles is direct. He says he wrote Donna Lee for the session. He says the recording company made a mistake when they listed Bird as the composer, and he says, essentially, that it wasn't worth making a fuss about because the financial stakes were really low. Bird was gone by the time the autobiography came out. He died in 1955, so Parker really couldn't respond. But then there's what Gil Evans told WKCR Radio in New York. Evans, who was one of the most careful listeners and most exacting arrangers in jazz, who in 1947 was working alongside all of the musicians and watching how ideas move between them, stated publicly that the actual source of the melody was Tiny Conn. Norman Tiny Conn was a drummer, arranger, a composer who worked primarily in and around New York in the 1940s and in the early 50s before dying of a heart attack at 33 years old in 1953. Conn had composed a tune with Indiana Changes that was very closely related to Donna Lee. Phil Shaep, the meticulous jazz archivist, connected this to a 1946 recording under the name Tiny's Kahn involving Aaron Sachs, a clarinetist who was in the same musical world as Kahn and the other young boppers who played in the post-midnight sessions. Terry Gibbs' autobiography also named Kahn as the originator and recalls Aaron Sachs playing a version of the melody before it was ever recorded as Donna Lee. That's Aaron Sachs playing Tiny's Kahn from 1946. And now you've heard Back Home in Indiana and Donna Lee. And now you're hearing this. I don't think they're twins, but they're definitely cousins? Maybe even brothers? So, Tiny Kahn writes something. Miles hears it, absorbs it, brings it to the session. The record company puts Bird's name on it. Bird doesn't object. He may not have even known, or he may not have even cared, or maybe genuinely he believed that the session was his. Miles objects decades later in his autobiography. Kahn is dead by then and has no book. What we're left with is a recording made on May 8, 1947 at a studio in New York City, credited to the Charlie Parker Quintet, featuring a melody of genuinely disputed origin, played at a tempo that would terrify most of the musicians who later encountered the tune in the real book. The fourth take was the master. The name on the label was Birds. Why is this tune called Donna Lee? Two words, a woman's name. Where did it come from? The most credible answer is Donna Lee Russell, the daughter of the bassist Curly Russell, who was a regular Parker sideman in the period. The connection is referenced in the literature. Through the exact mechanism of the naming isn't fully documented. There's also a curious appearance of the name in Charles Mingus's quasi-autobiography called Beneath the Underdog, one of my favorite books ever. Mingus writes of a period in his life when he had two simultaneous relationships with women named Donna and Lee Marie. When he introduced them to Miles Davis, he describes them together as a single ideal, calling them Donna Lee. Whether Mingus is riffing on the tune title or the tune title is riffing on the real women or both names just happen to overlap, this is the kind of thing that jazz history loves to make opaque. What's interesting about Donna Lee as a purely instrumental tune is how it differs from Bird's other major contrafacts in terms of what it communicates. Ornithology has a certain lyric flight to it. The melody sings. Anthropology is more rhythmically playful. Donna Lee is relentless, and it doesn't just lilt, it doesn't joke, it doesn't breathe, it just goes. Four note groups over every change, bebop eighth notes linking into phrases that push forward and never seem to arrive at rest. The emotional temperature is really high and it stays high. That quality, what you might call the urgency of the tune, is part of what has made this tune a test piece. It's one thing to play the changes to Indiana. It's another thing to play Donna Lee at tempo, because the melody itself tells you that what the tempo has to be. Too slow and it sounds wrong. Too slow and a four-note grouping loses its logic. The tempo is baked into the composition and the tempo is hard. The session that produced Donna Lee happened at the Harris Smith Studio in New York City, May 8th, 1947. Teddy Reig produced for Savoy Records. The personnel, that's Charlie Parker on alto saxophone, Miles Davis on trumpet, Bud Powell on the piano, Tommy Potter on bass, and Max Roach on the drums. Four tunes were cut that day, so it's Donna Lee, Chasing the Bird, Cheryl, and Buzzy. And Donna Lee was the first one recorded. Four takes, but take four is the master. That's the version that got the 78 RPM release and the one that all subsequent versions have measured themselves against. The musicians in that room deserve individual consideration.
Bud Powell on piano was, even in 1947, one of the most technically advanced pianists in jazz. His left-hand voicings are already setting the template for what bebop piano is going to sound like, and his right-hand lines move at the same arpeggiated velocity as Bird's lines. Tommy Potter, the bassist, was a steady, unshowy player who understood that in a bebop context, the bassist's job is to lock the changes and let the horns fly. Max Roach was 22 and already one of the most sophisticated drummers in the music. His hi-hat work and his ride cymbal had a precision and an intelligence that bebop required and that most drummers of the era just didn't have. And then, of course, there's Miles, 21 years old on trumpet. His solo on the original Donnelly is one of the most celebrated. Miles' strength in 47 was not at the extreme bebop tempos, and the recording bears this out. He plays with care rather than abandon, navigating the changes correctly, but without the ferocious ease that Birds brings to the alto lines. Some scholars have taken this as evidence that Miles didn't write the tune. The argument being that a composer generally has a deeper fluency in their own material. Others have taken it as a simple chronology. Miles wrote the line that pushed beyond what he could then play, which is what writers do when they are ambitious. The tune was copyrighted that year under Charlie Parker's name. Whether that's a clerical error, business convention, or even a deliberate attribution, Bird got the credit. So Savoy later released alternate takes from this session, which is how we know which takes, whether it's one, two, or three, we're hearing. We hear them in sequence, and it's instructive because the musicians are working out the feel on take one and two. By take four, there's a settled confidence in the performance. The tune knows what it is. Later in 1947, the tune moved into orchestral territory. Gil Evans, the arranger who was then running the musical language on Claude Thornhill's orchestra, heard Donnelly and wanted to arrange it for the big band. He approached Miles, asked for permission, and Miles agreed on one condition, that Evans show him the arrangement he'd done for Robin's Nest, a Thornhill staple, and Evans did. Miles started coming to the gatherings at Evans' small apartment behind a Chinese laundry on West 55th Street. Where musicians like Jerry Mulligan, Lee Konitz, John Lewis, and George Russell were meeting to talk about where jazz could go next. The Gil Evans arrangement of Donnelly for the Thornhill Orchestra was recorded for Decca later in 1947. It is a different creature from the Parker Quintet version. The bebop lines distributed across the orchestra. The harmonies opened up, the tempo somewhat more measured. But what matters for history is what exchange between Evans and Davis unlocked. The idea of taking the Thornhill sound, which is unusual instrumentation and non-swinging density, and shrinking it to the nonet. That idea became the birth of cool, and the birth of cool changed jazz. So Donnelly, whatever its origin, sits at the seed point of one of the most consequential aesthetic shifts in the music's history. Ha ha ha.
That's Brownie. The recording that defined Donnelly as a canonical bebop head is the original 1947 Parker Quintet version. But the recording that showed what the tune could mean, what weight it could carry, is the one that nobody in the room planned to be the last time anyone played it. June 25th, 1956, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Clifford Brown is at a jam session at a place called Music City Club. It's a hometown gig, an informal night, the kind of thing that you do between real engagements. Brown has been on the national scene for barely 4 years. In that time, he's recorded an extraordinary volume of work with Art Blakey, with Tad Dameron, with Lionel Hampton in Europe, and most significantly, with the Clifford Brown Max Roach Quintet, which he co-led since 1954. He's 25 years old and widely regarded as the most technically gifted trumpet player alive. At the jam that night, Brown plays several tunes with a local group. Billy Root on tenor, Sam Dockery on piano, Ace Tizone on bass, Ellis Tolan on drums. He plays Walkin'. He plays A Night in Tunisia. And then as the set closes, he plays Donna Lee. Just Brown and the rhythm section at a kind of tempo that makes your palms sweat. That's this recording. It was released in 1973, more than 15 years after the fact, by Columbia Records as part of an album called The Beginning and the End. Paired with some of Brown's earliest recordings from 1952, with Chris Powell's Blue Flames, the album title does exactly what it says. Brownie's playing that night, by every account, is at its absolute peak. He's not showing off, he's just playing. After that set, Clifford Brown told the audience he had to go. He and pianist Richie Powell, a younger brother of Bud Powell, a member of the quintet, and Powell's wife Nancy were driving home overnight to Chicago for the next engagement. Nancy Powell was at the wheel, driving through the rain on a Pennsylvania turnpike near Bedford. She lost control of the car. Clifford Brown, Richard Powell, and Nancy Powell were killed. June 26, 56, Clifford Brown was 25 years old and at his peak. Donna Lee was the last tune Clifford Brown ever played publicly, and his solo on that recording is by many ears the definitive trumpet statement on the tune. It's what he could do at bebop tempo, not avoiding the difficulty of the melody, but surpassing it, going faster, higher, deeper than most harmonies than the head itself can demand. This is what Brownie's Philadelphia recording does to Donna Lee. It demonstrates that the tune is not just a test, it's an invitation. The difficulty is really the point of entry. Thank you. are listening to The Standard Show on Biggie Radio, coming to you from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I'm your host. I'm Johanna Lean. And tonight we're deep inside Donna Lee, one of the most argued over tunes in the real book. You can find the show and all of the back episodes at the-standard-show.com. And now, back to the music. In 1976, Jacob Pastorius releases his debut solo album on Epic Records, and the first track is Donna Lee, played unaccompanied except for Don Alias on congas. No piano, no drums, no second chording instrument of any kind. Just a fretless electric bass guitar, a Fender Jazz Bass, with the frets removed and the fingerboard coated in epoxy, playing the entire bebop head at tempo, executing all the harmonic implications, then improvising through the form. Pat Metheny, who wrote the liner notes for the later reissue, called it astounding for what he describes as a horn-like phrasing previously unknown to the bass guitar. What Jaco brings that horn versions don't have is a physical particularity. The fretless bass's tone is warmer and more vocal. And at the moments where he uses harmonics, when he glides between pitches with the bass's natural portamento, the Indiana changes sound almost gentle underneath the bebop intensity. This tune doesn't stop him. He just keeps going. Studio Decca, Paris. Anthony Braxton, the Chicago alto saxophonist who'd come through the AACM and played with Circle alongside Chick Corea and Dave Holland. He records an album and he calls it Donna Lee. The title track is the bebop standard. Braxton's version is the most radical on this entire episode. He doesn't so much play the head as performs an excavation of it. The melody is there, buried under layers of free improvisation and atonal runs, the conscious decision to take the tune structure apart and see what remains. This is really outside jazz. The French rhythm section bashes along as he wails, producing a version that is simultaneously recognizable as Donnelly and completely unlike anything Parker or Davis had in mind. Braxton would return to this tune multiple times over his career, each version a different question about bebop and what the avant-garde owes it.
Thank you.
Nina Puente was born in New York City in 1923 and raised in East Harlem by Puerto Rican parents, and he trained at Juilliard after his Navy service. He could hear Cuba in just about anything. What he heard in the Indiana Changes of Donna Lee was a clave-ready harmonic sequence. Those 1-6-2-5 cycles that groove under a mambo feel with a naturalness that makes it feel designed. Puente's version is not a deconstruction and it's not a tribute. I think it's a Cuban translation. The bebop head is intact. It's fast, technically demanding, as Donna Lee is, but the rhythmic foundation has shifted entirely. The effect is genuinely surprising. I think it's fresh. The Indiana Changes, which in Parker's version sound like pure American mid-century jazz, here sound pan-hemispheric. Both things are always in the melody. Puente just chose a different one. Is in the Real Book Volume 1. It's attributed to Charlie Parker. The chart's in A flat major, the concert pitch key of the original 47 recording. The form is A, B, two 16-bar sections for a total of 32 bars. The melody is largely accurate in the Hal Leonard edition, though musicians who've done their homework check it against the Parker Omnibook, which is more carefully transcribed. The copyright in every edition, bootleg and legitimate, says Parker. Not Miles Davis, not Tiny Khan, not Unknown, Parker. Which brings us to the question the show has not yet opened up. Who decided what went into this book in the first place, and what did those choices canonize that might have been wrong? The Berklee students who made the original Reed book chose tunes that reflected what was being played most in the Boston jazz scene in the early 70s. They chose Donna Lee. They chose the name on the Savoy 78. They chose Charlie Parker. And they chose wrong, or at least they chose one disputed answer from a three-way argument and froze it into the canon. This is the thing about canon building that the Real Book makes visible. It's always a set of choices made by specific people at a specific time, reflecting specific tastes and specific assumptions. The Berklee students were not musicologists. They were musicians who needed a common reference, and so they built one. They didn't have access to Miles Davis's autobiography, which wouldn't be published until 1989. They may not have known about Gil Evans' WKCR interview or the Tiny Khan angle. They knew what was on the Savoy label. And so Donna Lee by Charlie Parker went into the book and into every version of the book. And into the Real Book app and into Real Book Pro. And now every student who learns the tunes learns it as a Charlie Parker composition. Donna Lee has held up in the canon of jazz because it's genuinely difficult and it's genuinely good. When you are playing over a great set of changes, you feel like you are on a carnival ride. Some tunes are really just fun to play. At jam sessions, Donna Lee is the tune that separates the players who've put in the time from the ones who are just guessing at it. The tempo isn't negotiable. The four-note bebop groupings require a level of fluency in the Indiana Changes that you only get from having run those changes hundreds of times. And the opening half-bar rest, beat one is silent, catches anyone who hasn't listened to the recording because the chart doesn't make it really obvious. That opening silence, in a way, is the whole tune's personality. It withholds the downbeat. It starts from expectation, not from arrival, and then it delivers way more than you expected, faster than what seems reasonable, for 32 bars without pause. The real book chart of Donna Lee will say Charlie Parker until someone changes the copyright. The debate about who actually wrote it will continue in forum threads and biographies and history classrooms, and the tune will keep getting called out of jam sessions by musicians who don't know the argument and they don't really need to. They just want to see if they can play it. The last time Clifford Brown played Donna Lee, he told the audience that he had to go, and he said it really casually, that he had to go. He had a gig in Chicago. There's a car waiting. He didn't know it was a goodbye. He was only 25 years old, and I keep coming back to that detail, not because the story is sad, though it is, but because what it means that he chose Donna Lee for those last bars. He could have played anything, and he played the hardest one, and he played it beautifully. That's one way to think about a jazz standard. Not the songs that are easy to love or the ones that are the prettiest or the one that everybody knows from the movies. A jazz standard is a tune that has enough room inside it for everything a musician needs to say. At the Tuesday night jam, on a studio recording, on the last night of your life, at the top of your game, and this is how it falls, Donna Lee has that kind of room. The changes are simple enough to be familiar, fast enough to be dangerous, and just ambitious enough in their origins that every musician who plays them brings something to the page they can't account for. This episode covered the May 8, 1947 Savoy Session, the three-way authorship dispute, and what it tells us about how jazz canons are built. The Clifford Brown Philadelphia recording, Jaco Pastorius in the 70s, fretless bass declaration, Anthony Braxton's wild interpretation of bebop, Tito Puente finding Cuba in the Indiana changes. If there is one recording I would point you to, it would definitely be Clifford Brown. And not because of the tragedy, but because of the playing. Because of the fact that somebody at their absolute best chose this tune for their final minutes on a stage. I've got one more for you tonight. I like a little Django jazz, I gotta tell you that straight up, and I just think this version makes it sound like Donna Lee was written for Django Reinhardt rather than as a bebop tune. Thank you. Joanna Aline, and you've been listening to The Standard Show, and tonight's standard was Donna Lee.
Hey there, music lovers. Did you know that getting licensed to share music online is not just the right thing to do? It's also super important for supporting creators and the music industry. That's why we're proud to be licensed by SOCAN, a copyright collective that grants licenses for online music broadcasts in Canada. By getting licensed through SOCAN, you ensure that every beat, every note, and every melody that you play is compliant and fair to the creators. Join us in supporting the music community. Visit SOCAN's website at www.socan.com and get your web radio, podcast, or any other use of online music licensed today. Let's stream beautiful music together, legally and ethically. SOCAN, music, people, connected.